This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. We are back on air today after a three-day hiatus for impeachment inquiry hearings. And since it's Friday, that's where we're going to begin with our week in review. According to testimony, President Trump set up a separate policy channel to Ukraine, one used to pressure Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate what the president believed was possible Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election on behalf of the Democrats and on Hunter Biden's relationship with Burisma, a Ukrainian company. The pressure campaign included withholding foreign aid approved by Congress. Witnesses this week also said that President Trump had pressed for these investigations into American citizens by a foreign power to aid his own 2020 presidential campaign. Here's Gordon Sondland, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union. He said on Wednesday that he was part of that channel and reported directly to President Trump, Vice President Pence, and other senior-level White House officials.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th, days before the presidential call.
Then on Thursday, Fiona Hill, a former National Security Council official and Russia expert, confirmed the existence of this second channel and said she now understood precisely what it was being used for.
Because he was being involved in a domestic political errand, and we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged.
But Republicans pushed back on several fronts, arguing that those testifying could not offer firsthand knowledge or evidence that the president ordered the pressure campaign for his own benefit, and that foreign aid ultimately was delivered without any of the desired investigations. Here's Devin Nunes, ranking Republican member of the House Intelligence Committee.
As numerous witnesses have testified, temporary holds on foreign aid occur fairly frequently for many different reasons. So how do we have an impeachable offense here when there's no actual misdeed and no one even claiming to be a victim?
Ooh, so there's a lot to break down. And here to help us is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Tom, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
Also, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, welcome back.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And you, we want to take your calls all the way through the week in review. Call us. Did you watch the hearings? If so, what were your biggest takeaways? And what do you think is the right path forward for the country now? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay. Arlene, let's start with you. What was your biggest takeaway from the week?
It was fascinating to watch the cast of characters that were testifying and toggling between being super impressed by them and wondering how they could manage to be so equivocal in their statements. That's the second one being Sondland. So starting with Fiona Hill, for example, it was fascinating to hear the backstories of these folks and hearing that she grew up in poverty, that her British accent would have kept her from advancing professionally in the UK. So she came here where everyone loves her accent.
I have heard a lot about her accent over the last 24 hours. This is true.
Really? The Americans who can't differentiate. And so actually she was smart and articulate and a friend of mine called her an oratorical dominatrix, albeit a diplomatic one, because her demeanor and comportment were so serious and commanding, but respectful at the same time. So it was wonderful to watch these people explain what happened, what they lived through, and to hear it from first and secondhand accounts.
So, Tom, who or what stood out for you?
Well, I think what stood out for me is there's a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Peggy Noonan,
yeah,
who is a very principled conservative columnist. And she has a piece that's running today, which I think reflects exactly how I feel, which is we now know what happened. There's no question that, in fact, there was a quid pro quo here, that, in fact, aid and a meeting with the president was held up in order to get the investigations into Biden, in order to start looking at the Ukraine server type of issue. We know that that happened. So at this point, what now stands out to me is the fact that you still have Republicans out there saying that even knowing what happened, and I think they knew what happened, they don't think of this as an impeachable offense. And I think that's the direction this is going to go, that they won't vote for impeachment, and when it gets to the Senate, you're not going to see a conviction.
Okay. And, you know, I don't know if it's that they don't think it's impeachable or they choose to not believe, want to see it as impeachable, because they clearly know, knowing Trump, knowing his reputation, knowing his background, they know what happened.
I think that's probably right, Arlene, that in fact what you have is you have clearly something that is not in action the president should be taking, but they're not going to impeach him because, quite frankly, many of them hail from states that are rabidly in support of Trump, and they're not going to go against their constituents.
I think that really raises a question. You know, I hear you, Tom. We now know what happened. Do we? I mean, is there not a significant portion of the country who would say, I do not agree with your assessment that these were witnesses who told us this is what happened? Will they say it was opinion? It was hearsay. There's no direct evidence that the president did this. Do we have a national consensus on what happened?
I'm going to stick with what Arlene just said, which is I think there's a willfulness to not listen to the evidence. But I think if you listen to the evidence with a fairly open mind, you're going to say, you know, Trump is overheard talking about the investigations. Sondland makes it clear that this was a process everyone was involved in.
Let's grab that sound for a second. So this is State Department official David Holmes on Thursday, and he's talking about this Sondland call.
I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do.
So to that point, Arlene, Republicans have argued no smoking guns and no firsthand testimony. Where do we situate Holmes hearing this call that was clearly a call between Sondland and the president? You said Sondland was equivocal. This doesn't sound – Holmes's view of what Sondland was talking about doesn't sound very equivocal.
No, it doesn't at all. And it was preposterous for Trump to suggest that you can't hear what someone is saying on a phone unless they're on speakerphone, because Lord knows I've many a time heard people speaking on cell phones to folks who have very loud voices. And you can, in fact, hear it.
Right. I call it airplanes before the
absolutely.
Cell phone is shut off.
That's right. So I think, in fact, that it is, in fact, there. You know, that adage, when it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, sounds like a duck, 10-1, it's a duck. But the duck doesn't have to say, hey, everyone, I am a duck. And, you know, no, they don't have him on, they don't have Trump on tape saying, I have committed bribery. But everything else says that he did.
All right. I want to pick up another piece of sound here, because Republicans also argue that it's not necessarily unique to have a separate channel to a foreign entity for a president. This is Devin Nunes, California Republican, on Wednesday, arguing that one of America's most revered presidents did the same thing.
The Democrats' fake outrage that President Trump used his own channel to communicate with Ukraine. I'll remind my friends on the other side of the aisle that our first president, George Washington, directed his own diplomatic channels to secure a treaty with Great Britain.
Fair point, Tom?
I think that actually is a fair point. And I don't think the outrage, quite frankly, is that people are saying, oh, there's other channels in use here. Presidents use other channels and multiple channels to try to communicate on foreign policy, some within the State Department, some clearly going outside to try to set up some sort of relationship. That's not the problem. The problem is what Giuliani was asking for. It wasn't that it was Giuliani. It is what he was asking for, which was essentially the quid pro quo.
And it wasn't simply a quid pro quo, in my opinion. It's what that quid pro quo was about. He wasn't using a back channel to try and enhance the benefits to the United States of America. He was doing it to enhance benefits for himself personally and politically.
This was something that I was struck about, and I apologize that I don't remember the name of the person who was being interviewed on NPR this morning, but I was listening to an elected official talk about the fact this morning that this was within the president's rights to seek this investigation because he was concerned about Ukrainian corruption. So where do we place this Ukrainian corruption argument? I mean, were one to stipulate that, the president of the United States is within his rights to set foreign policy to do such things, Tom?
Right. So he can set foreign policy. But the problem is that it was it seemed quite clear to everybody who has been involved here that it was not corruption that mattered, but rather going after Joe Biden, who at the time he really perceived as his number one challenger in the next election. Now, maybe not so much so.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pull up a seat at the table. Join the conversation. Nick from Framingham, you're on with Tom and Arlene. What's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to touch in and say, so I'm personally of the opinion, after listening to probably 90% of all the testimony in the last couple of weeks, that it is very obvious what happened. We all know what happened. It's fairly obvious given what people say and just given the president's history and how we clearly all see how he does things. However, I do not see, and I believe that if that's the case and he withheld military aid to the Ukraine, then that is impeachable. However, I do not see any real definitive proof that it was actually, that he actually directed this, gave this direction. When Nixon was impeached, we had audio tapes of him actually speaking. When Clinton was impeached, we had DNA evidence and a witness that said, yes, this happened with him. I am the other party involved in this situation. And I just don't see that equivalent here. Yeah,
thanks,
we could
Nick.
Set a new precedent, but if we're looking at prior precedent, I just don't see the equivalent.
I'm going right. to pick that up. Nick, that's helpful. And I'm going to add some sound to Nick's case and then turn it over to our two panelists. This is Ohio Republican Brad Winstrup, who took issue with Gordon Sondland's presuming that the president was asking that aid be withheld to force an investigation. Here's what he said to Sondland on Wednesday.
You see, in mathematic fact, 2 + 2 does equal 4. But in reality, 2 + 2 does not equal even 1 fact. And the fact is, the president did tell you, Ambassador Sondland, no quid pro quo.
So what is the appropriate threshold, to Nick's point from Framingham and to Brad Winstrup's point, what is the appropriate threshold of evidence to say there was intention, it's clear the president did it, you know, what really? We are so divided. How do we find a path forward understanding the evidence?
Well, first of all, I think it's completely disingenuous. I mean, the caller makes an interesting point, but I think it's totally disingenuous of the Republicans to say that Trump very specifically said no quid pro quo, because he did not say that until after he was caught with his hand in the cookie jar.
I think he said that in September, right? And the call was in July.
Once the whistleblower had come out and there was already talk of investigations about this. So just like a kid who's got their hands in a cookie jar and the mom said, are you stealing that cookie? Oh, no, I was just touching the cookie to see what it looked like. So it's silly for the Republicans to hide behind that. Trump is nothing if not a brilliant performer, and he was performing there for a stage that he knew at some point he could quote.
How about you, Tom? What do you think?
Well, I think Nick's point is that there is no smoking gun. I mean, as Nick said, we know what happened. After watching the testimony, after watching the hearings, we actually do know what happened. And if this were a traditional court of law, the facts and circumstances are such that you could easily convict. But this isn't a traditional court of law. People want that smoking gun. They actually want the president on tape saying, I decided to do something illegal and did it. And absent that, we're going to have enough political cover that you're not going to be able to see a supermajority of the Senate move to a conviction.
All right. I'd like to put together two calls here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Morris from Groton and Chris from Wellfleet, and they may give us a point counterpoint. So, Morris, you are up first. Pull up a seat at the table. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just want to make the point that Sondland did clearly state that nobody had ever previously directed him to a quid pro quo. And just to mark the point about the Republicans hiding behind that statement by the president, that's supported with the fact that prior to that statement, nobody has a claim of the president stating no quid pro quo or no actual quid pro quo. So I think there's support behind that. The question I have is, did everybody hear that this deal was coming from Sondland? I mean, Sondland's, maybe he's got an ego that allowed him to perceive this and then spread it. So what was the origination? Who started the story of this is quid pro quo?
Okay, Morris, I'm going to take it from there. Thank you, because I want to add Chris from Wellfleet. Chris, you're up.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think that this really is kind of a situation of the emperor has no clothes on and people just don't want to admit it. I think, sadly, I do believe that the press actually plays into that. I think that There's no doubt with all those people and all that was involved, it isn't just about one phone call. His whole administration was working to get these two things done, an investigation into Joe Biden and into the server. And I don't think there can be any doubt about it. All these people know of it. So by saying that Trump was not involved with it is ridiculous. He is a control freak.
Okay, so, Chris, I'm going to pick it up from there. Thank you so much. So it was so great to have Morris and Chris because they represent, I mean, these are thoughtful people who have paid attention and care. They're taking the time to call in and enter this discussion. They do not see this the same way. What to do about that? Either of you, Tom,
Marlene? I think they raise fair points, but I think the answer is that Sondland said very clearly, everyone was in the loop, and he named this one knew, that one knew, this one knew. And if all those people knew, either it is the worst-run department administration in the history of the world, which actually I think it is, because you had all these people doing something that supposedly the president did not wish them to do, or in fact they were all following along the lines of what Giuliani had been asking for. And it's very clear that they were. So, you know, I think we have a standard right now that you know, we're not – this isn't a standard for whether or not to convict someone to send them to jail or to execution. This is whether or not someone has behaved properly and not followed the Constitution and should not be the leader of this country.
Tom, one of the things Arlene said, I've zeroed in on a couple times this week. Where does Rudy Giuliani stand in all of this? And how exposed at the end of the day, legally, sort of – normatively, is he in all
right
of
it? And that's actually a great question, and something that people have speculated with me about too. Is Giuliani going to be the fall guy for this whole thing? Because he clearly is implicated. My guess is if you wanted to go after him and you had the proper subpoenas and the proper people testifying, you probably would find out that he had been giving a lot of these orders. And he very well could become just the fall guy for Trump here. And he's probably loyal enough that he would never give up Donald Trump.
Okay, I want to bring up one more subject on this before we go to a break. This is Fiona Hill, former National Security Council official and Russia expert. She is worrying that by supporting Giuliani and Trump's quest to investigate the CrowdStrike Ukraine interference theory on 2016, that we're playing into Russia's hands.
Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves.
So there is a presidential election going on right now. We had a Democratic presidential debate this week. The primaries are not that far off. Do we have our eye on the right ball here, Arlene?
Well, she raises a very good point. And being an expert as she is on Russia and Ukraine, it was particularly helpful for her to disabuse people of the notion that it's a total fiction that Ukraine was involved in the 2016 elections. So, yes, I think you're right. We're heading into a meat grinder in 2020 like we faced in 2016. If I may, I just want to say one more thing about the previous callers when they were saying, well, there's no one who said it specifically. Trump has set it up by denying people by telling people to not testify in these hearings. So the very people who could say, yes, I have firsthand knowledge, yes, the president said it to me, are the very people who have not been permitted to testify because Trump won't allow them.
Hey, Tom, last thought on this before a break.
So, in terms of Fiona Hill's point, the thing that strikes me about it is I think she's right. It is Russia. What has been striking me about the Russia thing since 2016 is that Donald Trump refuses to ever name Russia as a bad actor and seems to seek out anybody, Ukraine, anybody else, except for Vladimir Putin.
Okay, so Tom, Arlene, listeners, everyone stick around. We're going to take a short break, come back and talk about a couple of state house bills. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are continuing our Week in Review. Massachusetts could be the first state to ban the sale of flavored tobacco and nicotine products. The bill is sitting on Governor Baker's desk. It was approved by the state legislature this week. State Senator John Keenan told Radio Boston on Monday that the groundbreaking ban is about curbing youth smoking.
We had made great progress over the course of many years in reducing nicotine use among teenagers, and particularly through tobacco products. And all that has been reversed and, in fact, lost with the introduction of e-cigarettes, and particularly e-cigarettes with flavored e-liquids.
But Carlos Nestor in Dorchester told WBZ Channel 4 that this takes away his autonomy as an adult who smokes.
It will make it so difficult right now for the people who already smoke menthol cigarette, like to take it away from them.
Okay, still with us in Studio 3, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Thanks for staying with us.
Absolutely.
And Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks for staying with us through the break.
Sure thing.
You too. Thanks for staying with us and join the conversation again. What do you think of the new flavored tobacco ban across all the delivery mechanisms? You think any part of that bill is a step too far, or do you support it? Should menthol cigarettes be included in the ban as they are? And the ban is targeted towards youth smoking. Will it work? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, Arlene and Tom, there are three key pieces basically to this bill. It bans flavored vapes. It bans all remaining flavors, menthol, mint, of cigarettes, cigars, chewing tobacco. And it levies an excise tax on remaining vape products. If it's signed into law, it will be the first state basically to take all flavored tobacco and nicotine products off the market. Is that a good thing, Tom?
It's a wonderful gift to the people of New Hampshire. The retailers there are just going to be thrilled. I think this is ridiculous. And by the way, this comes in the context of where we have just gone through, and we are going through a process of legalizing a formerly illicit substance, which is marijuana. And now everyone, apparently that's fine, but we're deciding that we're going to ban for all people, not just for children, but for all people, any flavored tobacco-related products. I think that's clearly a step too far. I completely agree that this is a crisis within schools. I know kids who, you know, particularly in high schools, are using vapes all the time. The estimate is maybe 25% of them have tried it. I would say it's actually higher at this point. It really has become a problem, but you can't and you should not try to target misuse by one subset, which is basically, you know, young people, and ban it altogether for adults.
So, and Arlene, what about that corresponding rise and fall that Tom is talking about, that we're excluding more and more tobacco and nicotine products from the market as we've legalized marijuana? From a public policy standpoint, what does that tell the people? Where is the state going?
Well, I know it is problematic to have prohibitions on certain substances, for example, the ones Tom mentioned. But on the other hand, we do, in fact, do it all the time. We make decisions all the time about what can and can't be sold in Massachusetts. So it's not an exact analogy, but we ban certain kinds of guns here. And someone could make the argument, well, they can just go across the border and buy an AK-47 in another state. Nonetheless, we made a public policy decision that it was worth banning them here. So I think that the New Hampshire analogy does not always work. Number two, there are states that do, California in particular, ban certain products and ingredients on a regular basis. Candidly, I think we all benefit as a result of it because we have fewer toxic chemicals in some of our, you know, shampoos or whatnot. So I think it's legitimate, but while I'm not a fan of bans, the fact of the matter is that we are facing an epidemic, particularly among young people. And to use the New Hampshire analogy is sort of like saying, well, New Hampshire can poison kids, so why can't we? And I think most people would say that's not quite right.
No, but it's New Hampshire can also sell to adults. Why can't we sell to adults? And, you know, many of those really do fall apart. OK, and in the gun case, the reason we care about guns is because they're used to hurt other people. The whole idea behind products that I simply use for myself is I should have the right to choose to use those products. And if it's going to hurt my health, I'm an adult and I can make that decision. In the same way
But some people like playing. They like shooting guns. You know, they love going to target practice. So
Right, and we allow those people to buy those kinds of guns and do target practice.
Not AK-47s.
Well, not AK-47s, but certainly in terms of rifles and target shooting, we absolutely do allow that to happen. We allow adults to make adult decisions, even undergoing activities like skiing, for example, that are risky, or mountain climbing, or deciding to smoke marijuana, or deciding to use a vape. I don't see what compels an overall ban here simply to protect a group of people 0 to age 18.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Callers are lighting up the phones, and I want to get to this one from Max in Needham. Max, you are on the line with Tom and Arlene. What's on your mind?
I think that they should take all of these flavors off of the market because they have flavors that especially appeal to children. Like, they have cotton, a flavor that is called cotton candy. So I think taking these, like, child-inspired flavors off the market would be a good way to reduce vaping of youth.
Maxim, can I assume that you are a young person yourself?
Yes, you can.
And Max, have you been seeing vaping in your neighborhood or with kids your age, your kids in the schools around you?
Yes, kids older than me, though.
Say, how old are you, Max?
I am 13 years old.
Okay, and your mom's with you there, right?
Yeah, she's right here.
All right. Hey, thanks for calling in, Max. I'm going to turn it back over to our panel from there. So, Arlene, here's a kid, or Tom, right? Here's a kid, actually. I'll go to you, Tom, saying, hey, I am seeing this. I am a kid. I approve this ban. What do you think?
And I agree. I think kids should approve that ban for children. And again, the question is, why are we banning, say, menthol cigarettes, which have been around for a long, long time, for adults? I don't think there's any reason to do that. Yes, one might construct the argument that there perhaps are certain vaping products so focused only on children, and maybe bubblegum counts as one of them. Oh, I like bubblegum, you know, and cotton candy. But maybe they count, and that would be an effective way to do it. But we're really starting off with the classic banned in Boston thing. Let's just ban it for everybody, even though it's only a small subset that we really want to target.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Otis is calling from Groton. Otis, pull up a seat. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
I agree with Tom there. The reality is that so long as the product doesn't cause harm to other people, such as an AK-47, it's my contention that as long as we encourage and allow government to continue to ban a variety of products, there's not going to be any end to this. And if you believe in the general freedom of the individual, which this country was indeed based on, one has to say, government, focus on information, fight back against the false advertising of, you know, no danger by the tobacco companies, but allow people to make their own decisions, like going skiing, as he said, or vaping. That's
okay. Thanks, Otis. And I will tell you, you did make Tom quite happy with your agreement there. I want to pick up one more call. Casey from Belmont, please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to bring up the therapeutic benefits that are going to be lost when this ban goes into effect. As a former smoker, I've used vapes especially tobacco flavored vapes, to get off of smoking. And this bill doesn't bring that up, doesn't address it. We have a public health system in Massachusetts, which will become burdened with people getting cancer as they return to smoking.
All right. That's a strong point, too, Casey. Thank you. And Arlene, so choice and control, strategies to deal with one's own life, with one's own health issues, the concerns that banning tend to push people instead of to cessation, instead to illicit or black market. How do we, from a public health standpoint, think about those issues in this context?
I think the callers make fair points, and I actually don't disagree with the things that they said. And in fact, I feel badly for the store owners who are going to be hurt by this. I don't think it's black and white. I don't think it's either we have absolutely no bans or prohibitions on anything that can be sold in this country. I think this is a quintessential example of situational ethics. It depends. It depends on the instance. Now, in this case, when are we dealing with kids? To me, it's a compelling argument. And I wonder about dealing with menthol, knowing that, as we do now, that it's an anesthetic that that's added to products to numb the throat so that you can inhale the smoke more deeply. So, it's corporations clearly setting people up to become addicted.
All right. There's a lot more to talk about here, but I do want to get to one more thing because there is another bill sitting on Governor Baker's desk this week. State legislators passed a landmark education funding bill. It would increase state aid to Massachusetts schools to the tune of nearly $1.5 billion over the next 7 years. Northampton Rep. Lindsay Sabadosa told WWLP News that even though the bill's focused on low-income urban districts struggling to cover costs, all communities will stand to benefit from it.
This is really important progress for a lot of our school districts. We're going to see a huge influx of money, and it really relies on the principle that all ships rise together.
It is also the first real update to our education funding formula since the Education Reform Act passed back in 1993. Mary Najimy, president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, told WBUR the money is really going to make a difference.
Lowering class sizes, restoring art programs and librarians, those are all of the things that have been lost over the last 25 years.
We want you to keep calling. What impact could more funding for education have in your community? What do you think took so long to get the bill passed? $1.5 billion almost over 7 years. It's a lot. Is it enough? Is it too much? What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Tom and Arlene, I just want to note, Tom, you work for an early education company in D.C. that might eventually stand to benefit from increased spending. And Arlene, at one point earlier in your career, you worked with the lobbying with the Massachusetts Teachers Association.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So just so that listeners know that you both have some maybe old dogs in this hunt or however you want to
put it. Well, as a matter of fact, I worked on that 1993 bill. That was the last education reform funding bill. And I'm thrilled that they finally passed this measure because our schools, our K-12 schools have been underfunded for decades. Even back then, when that bill passed, many of us knew that they had tweaked the variables within the formula intentionally to lessen the amount of money that they knew was necessary. For example, in speaking to the man, the brilliant man who put together one of the parts of the funding formula, I pointed out to him, hey, for special needs, you put in X percent, and that's way below what's actually happening. And he said, yeah, that's true. I did it because that's an aspirational number. It's what I'd like it to be. It's not what it really is. As a result of that, special education, as but one example, has been underfunded for decades.
So why should people believe that it will be any different with this bill, Tom? Do we know if these formulas are going to cover costs in a way that 1993 didn't?
So it appears to. I agree with Arlene. The 1993 bill was a terrific piece of legislation, and the formulas under it simply were not working as they were intended to work or really should have worked. This is an attempt really to correct those formulas. The reality is that we have, you know, historically in the United States and in this Commonwealth, funded education out of local property taxes, which means that wealthy communities have really great schools and communities that do not have much wealth, and yet at the same time, almost always have the greatest need, do not have the same base to fund their schools. This is an effort to change that dynamic, to actually make it so that poorer off areas, the most needy areas, are getting more money for their schools so that they can actually educate at the, you know, at least approximating the same level as the wealthier districts. I think this is, it seems to me like this formula is going to work. I mean, maybe 10 years from now, we find out someone else had an aspirational figure that didn't pan out. But right now, it looks to me like this is fixing a problem we should have fixed in 1993.
I completely agree. I give the legislature a lot of credit for this one. It's something where left and right seem to have, for the most part, agreed, Republican and Democrat. It's a very good bill.
It's almost unanimously passed, right?
Right.
It's incredible.
So to be the stinker at the table a little bit, people have known for a long time that funding formula wasn't working.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So why did it take this long? And on the flip side, what was different this year that it finally passed when we have not been able to get this reform of the Education Reform Act for a very long time?
So I'd give a lot of credit to Senator Chain-Diaz, Sonia Chain-Diaz, who really pushed this through very, very hard. And as I think you may recall, last year, essentially the same legislation fell apart when it got to conference amid lots of recriminations, and I'm not even sure what those were over. It seems that this year we've been able to get over those issues. In particular, I know there was a concern about, you know, are some communities actually going to be hurt in this funding formula? Now it seems that that's not going to be the case. And then the second had been, would you have enough state oversight of the local community's plans for how to spend this money? And that now appears to have greater state oversight than we would have had before.
Arlene, I want to ask you, will the governor sign it? I mean, the legislature has passed it, but it's sitting on the governor's desk now. And when he entered his version of the legislation, it had a little less money and required more accountability, arguably, than this final bill does. Will he sign it?
I'm inclined to think he will because of so many communities that benefit from it. And it'd be crazy not to, you know. I know he has a different perspective on some of the aspects that you just mentioned, but at the end of the day, Republicans and Democrats did vote for the bill. It helps suburban and urban and rural towns, which is extremely important. And there were, you know, to answer your question about why I didn't get here earlier, there were differences between those different kinds of towns and those different types of demographics. But Lewis and Paish and Sonia together, they worked, and the House and the legislature produced, I think, a pretty damn good bill.
So, Tom, you know, $1.5 billion over 7 years is a lot of money. What is the right level of accountability to be requiring of school districts? And does this bill hit the accountability balance appropriately?
So that was part of the challenge. I think in some earlier versions of the bill, or at least in the proposals, really had it so that local communities could make their plans and the state, you know, state could look at those plans and make recommendations, but not necessarily permit, you know, say that, no, that can't be the plan. Now the state has a greater role in kind of be action forcing in terms of having to approve the plans themselves. I think that's what you want. Now, you raise a really great broad point, which is that simply throwing money at a problem doesn't solve the problem. I think money is an issue here. Money is an issue here. But and we clearly need more money. But if it's not going to be properly spent, if in fact, you know, this goes for extraneous things that have nothing to do with really raising up students' levels of achievement, then it will have been a wasted effort. I will say, look into the 1993 legislation, and for all of the flaws that it has in terms of the funding formula, Massachusetts has really done well educationally. Our schools have dramatically improved. We typically now rank number one in terms of all of the states in terms of academic achievement. And I go back to crediting that 1993 legislation.
All right, I'm going to have to move us on from there because I do want to have time for our hubbubs, which are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Arlene, let's have you go first. Did you bring us a hubbub?
Well, my hubbub this week is a little different. It's for the holidays that many people refer to as Thanksgiving. This is not about a story, but a storyline from this week's impeachment hearings. Having listened to people like Alexander Vindman and Marie Yovanovitch and David Holmes, Fiona Hill, all of those people who chose public service, who chose to dedicate their careers to our nation, who chose public service over their pocketbooks. I've been incredibly impressed by these public servants who are so dedicated that in serving their country that they are willing to risk harassment and reprisals to do what's right, to put themselves in the spotlight for public scrutiny, by telling the truth, by testifying when they should. And it displays to me not just bravery and courage, but also a love of the Constitution, which I think is very noteworthy here. So I think we're lucky, and I am particularly grateful to people who are willing to do that kind of – the fact that they work for us. So in this week, I'm especially thankful to these public servants who are usually unsung heroes, but who now put themselves, their careers, and even the safety of their families on the line.
All right. Good. Thank you. Sorry, I just want to get to Tom, too. Tom, what's
well
yours?
Done, Arlene.
Yeah, that was moving.
Mine's much snarkier than yours. The Boston Globe this week released a spotlight investigation of traffic in the Boston area. The bottom line, for many, especially commuters, it's bad and it's getting worse. However, the solutions that got advanced all seem fairly punitive. Make it more expensive to drive or to park. Add new fees to Uber and Lyft rides. Push folks as much as possible to travel via public transit, bicycles, or simply walking. Here's the problem, though. We like to drive. In our cars, we're in our own little worlds. We don't have annoying train riders jostling us. We can do anything we want. Yeah, we can try to force people to get out of their cars, and my guess is that with high enough penalties, some will give in, especially those whose incomes are lower and can't tolerate the extra hit. But politically speaking, it's hard to imagine this happening. Politicians rarely win when they try to punish us for doing what we want. So how about a different approach? Maybe what we should do is add lanes, as was recently done on Route 128, clean up bad interchanges, create pullover spaces for rides for hire, and reconsider rarely used bike lanes that just squeeze cars into single file. In other words, instead of making driving harder, let's make it easier.
All right. Two great hubs. Tom Keene, Arlene Isaacson, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.